I want to welcome everybody on behalf of Torah in Motion to this is, I guess, now the beginning of our fourth week of doing these classes. We have many, many classes. I welcome if you can listen to them online. It's really been making the best of the situation that we're all going through. We're having amazing Torah scholars from around the world to teach us, and it's a pleasure this morning to welcome Rabbi Adam Mintz. We go back many years to our days in Smicha at Yeshiva University together. Rabbi Mintz serves as the rabbi of Kilat Rayim Ahovim, which he founded on the West Side. It was previously rabbi in Lincoln Square Synagogue. He runs, as he put us, his title 929, the English department. Of course, Rabbi Benny Lau founded the 929, the Daf Yomi of Tanakh. And Rabbi Mintz runs it for the North American division. He did his PhD in Erevin, the history of Erevin, and we had the pleasure of hearing him come to Toronto and speak about the history of the Toronto Erevin, which was one of the early Erevin in North America. And without further ado, it's a pleasure to have Rabbi Mintz speak on grape juice and prohibition. Bevakasha.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelvin. Thanks. First of all, you deserve a lot of credit because, like you just said, you know, to turn around and, you know, literally overnight to become the center of so much learning over the past 4 weeks is an amazing thing. And of all the things that are going on, and, you know, we're kind of on overdrive and on internet learning, the stuff that Torah Motion has, you know, it's always going to be quality stuff, and you know, it's always going to be done properly. And so thank you very much for including me. Okay. The week before Pesach. So what I want to do is I want to talk about the Seder. I want to talk about something that relates to everybody at the Seder. And that is whether or not you're allowed to use grape juice instead of wine. Now, that's a pretty basic question, right, Boaz? Right, Alyssa, that's a pretty basic question. Can you use grape juice instead of wine? Now, before we even discuss the halachic issue, the legal issue, we need to figure out, first of all, what exactly is grape juice? Like, how do you make grape juice? And in what way is grape juice different than wine? Meaning, is grape juice just unfermented wine, or is there something different about grape juice than wine? So let's start at the beginning. How do you make wine? You need to have just a quick wine making class. So there are three parts of the grape. There's the juice, the pulp, and the skin. Red wine is made by leaving the skin in. White wine is made by leaving the skin out. What happens is you put these grapes into a fermentation vat, and then the grape juice becomes wine. And that happens naturally because the natural yeast in the grapes converts the sugar in the grapes into alcohol. Now, until the 19th century, fermentation was not understood all that well. And if you look at the history books, you'll see that the wines were of varying qualities in the Middle Ages. It was often, the taste was often uneven. Sometimes you read that there was an acidy taste to the wine. That's because they didn't understand how fermentation worked. Louis Pasteur in the 1850s figured out that by heating the juice during the fermentation process or before the fermentation process, you could kill some of the yeast. And therefore, you could control the fermentation. That's the key here, is that you could control the fermentation. And therefore, it's really thanks to Louis Pasteur that we have modern wine, that we have wines that taste as good as they do. In 1869, in southern New Jersey, there was a dentist. This dentist was a prohibitionist. That meant that he was against the use of wine in the church. Long before the 18th Amendment in 1920, there were already prohibitionists. Now, the funny thing is that his name was Dr. Thomas B. Welch. Yes, Welch's grape juice is named after this dentist, Dr. Thomas B. Welch. And he experimented with Pasteur's idea of cooking or heating the juice. What he did was that before the fermentation process, he cooked the grapes and he squeezed out the juice. He plugged up the bottles of the juice and immersed them in boiling water. And what happened was he was able to create grape juice that did not ferment into wine. That was the beginning of grape juice. Again, he was able by heating up, and this is all going to be important in the halacha of grape juice. He was able by heating up the grapes before the fermentation process, he was able to turn to keep the grape juice as grape juice and not to have it turn into wine. Now, an important thing which we all know from grape juice is that the only way he was able to maintain this grape juice without it going bad was to refrigerate the grape juice, to put it into some kind of ice box. Because if you ever open a bottle of grape juice and you leave it out of the refrigerator, we all know what happens to grape juice. It goes bad. So he was able to cook the grapes, keep it as grape juice, and then keep it good by putting in the ice box in the early refrigerators. Now, that was the beginning of grape juice. Grape juice, as you could imagine, was very slow in terms of being introduced as a drink, and more specifically as a religious drink. We don't have any halachic material about grape juice in the end of the 19th or early 20th century. And it seems also that the church rejected grape juice. They were not interested in this, you know, creation of Dr. Welch. But now let's pivot for a minute. And let's talk about what halacha, let's try to create our own discussion of this topic. Let's talk about what halacha requires from wine. So the Gemara says at the end of Maseches Pesachim, Zacharet Yom HaShabbat LeKadsho, you should remember Shabbos to keep it holy. Says the Gemara, Zochreyu Al Hayay, remember it on wine. That the way to remember Shabbos is to remember it on wine. Tosus points out there are a couple of psukim, maskiro dodecha miayin, that connect the word zachar with the word wine. So there's an obligation, there's a disagreement whether the obligation to make kiddush on wine on Friday night is an obligation from the Torah or only a rabbinic obligation. But everybody agrees that there's an obligation on Friday night to make kiddush on wine. The wine that they knew about in the Talmudic period, in the Roman period, was fermented alcoholic wine. However, there was another type of wine, which the Gemara is familiar with, something called Yayin Migito, which is wine which is right out of the press before it ferments. Not that it's prevented, you see, this is different than Dr. Welch. Not that it's prevented from fermenting, but if you drink it before it has a chance to ferment. So what's the halacha concerning the wine? The first question is, so there's something else about wine, something that we're familiar with when it comes to wine. That's what's called mevushal, wine that's cooked or boiled. Why do we have mevushal wine, is what it's called? Because there's another prohibition unrelated to Pesach or Friday night Kiddush, which says that wine that's touched by a non-Jew, you're not allowed to use that wine. Stam yena. That's a fascinating question. I'm sure that Rabbi Kelman will have a good class someday after Pesach about stam yena. But wine that's cooked is not considered to be stam yena. There's a question, first of all, whether wine that's cooked is actually considered wine. Do you make a borei pri hagafen on that wine? The Shulchan Aruch says that yes, you make a borei pri hagafen on cooked wine, but if you have uncooked wine, that's preferable. That's why sometimes when you go to people's houses and they prefer to make kiddush on Friday night on non-cooked wine. It's also because the quality of the wine is better, and also because it's better in terms of making a borei pri hagafen. Now, at what temperature does wine become mevushal, cooked in this regard? So actually, That was a machloket in the end of the 20th century between Rav Moshe Feinstein and someone by the name of the Tzelem HaRav, a Hasidic Rebbe called the Tzelem HaRav. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that wine boils at 165 degrees. The Tzelem HaRav says that wine is only considered boiled at 190 degrees. Now you think, who cares, right? I mean, generally, we don't put a thermometer into our yayin mevushel. What difference does it make whether it's 165 degrees or 190 degrees? But you'll be happy to know that grape juice is pasteurized at 175 degrees. So according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, grape juice falls into the category of yayin mevushel, which means that you can make a borei piagafen on grape juice, but it's preferable to use wine over grape juice. The Tzelem HaRav said that no, grape juice is not considered mevushal, and therefore even as a, in the first instance, what they call the chatchila, you are allowed to make a borei piagafen on grape juice. Now, today, if you look at your bottle of Kedem grape juice, the Kedem grape juice has an OU on it. But Bella will remember that it wasn't that many decades ago that the Kedem bottle of grape juice did not have an OU on it, but rather it had the hashgacha of the Tzelem HaRav. This Hasidic Rebbe, I have no idea who he was, but he was an important rabbi. And he said that grape juice is considered to be wine, even in the first instance. That's because he believed that wine only was considered to be mevushal at 190 degrees. Therefore, grape juice was still considered to be non-mevushal and therefore could be used as wine even in the first degree. Okay, so here we go. So is grape juice wine? So that's a good question. And the answer is, I was a disagreement between Rav Moshe Feinstein. Well, everybody agrees it's wine. Is it wine in the first instance? Is it something you should choose to make a borei piagafen on? So that was a disagreement between Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Tzelem HaRav. But until 1920, grape juice was not used for Kiddush at all. We don't have any record of grape juice being used for Kiddush. Why not? Because the thing you make Kiddush on is, of course, the thing that you're used to making Kiddush on. And if you're used to making Kiddush on wine, somehow making Kiddush on grape juice seems to be sacrilegious. On January 16th, 1920, the 18th Amendment is introduced. That's the 18th Amendment against prohibiting the sale and manufacture of alcoholic beverages in the United States. Prohibition. Now, we know that prohibition didn't start in 1920. There had been a prohibition movement basically since the 1800s. Seems especially in the United States that people believe that people had been drinking in the United States from 1776. They used to drink, said one, in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. All the American founders did was drink. So there was this prohibition movement, which felt as if the men were not working hard enough, were being abusive to their wives because they were drinking too much. Finally, at the beginning of 1920, the prohibitionists were successful in getting prohibition passed in the United States Congress. It became the 18th Amendment to the Constitution. Now, together with this 18th Amendment came something called the Volstead Act. Volstead was a senator, and he kind of defined what the amendment was about. A very, very important limitation to prohibition was that wine was allowed for religious purposes. It was allowed in the church and it was allowed in the synagogue. Now, How did they distribute wine? So interestingly, the church and the Jews are different, because in the church service, the wine is used in the church service. It was much easier to control wine because you could just give it to the church. The problem with Jews is that they use wine at home. So they need to be given wine to be used at home. And therefore, the possibility of abuse is much greater. The Volstead Act said the following, that the government was going to identify several rabbis in each city. And each rabbi would have the authority to give out a certain amount of wine to each person based on the size of their family and their need. And what they would do is they would give you a little ticket, which would say, okay, the Mintz family has five people, and therefore they get two bottles of wine for Pesach. They give me two tickets. I go to the wine company, to Shapiro Wine Company. I get my two bottles of wine. I go home and I have a nice Pesach. Now, that just sounds like it's trouble. Before I even tell you the story, that just sounds like it's trouble. Because come on, I'm going to meet with my rabbi and I'm going to say, listen, you know, we like to drink wine. It's a hard year. We would like to drink wine. I'll give you an extra $5 if you give me two more tickets, so I'll be able to get more wine. You can imagine the Mintzes are just the Mintzes. But if I wanted to go into business, maybe I could pay $1,000 and get 100 more tickets. And then I could sell those tickets and make a lot more money. And you can imagine that there could be a tremendous business, a wine business, meaning that the system, and you know, lahavdil, you say, but you see from coronavirus that, you know, when people are not ready for something, so the system, it's hard to control the system. So in a very different way, they introduced prohibition, but they didn't really think about the fact that rabbis could be on the take and that therefore, you know, they could want to make some money in giving out these tickets. Well, actually, most of this was under the table. Until a story was broken on Pesach 1921. First of all, if you guys are looking for a fun book to read over Pesach, there's a book called Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition, written by a fantastic professor. Her name is Marnie Davis. You can't beat it, Jews and Booze. That's why you should buy it just for that. She tells the story of the Menorah Wine Company in downtown Manhattan. We would call that the Lower East Side. And one day before Pesach 1921, just think about it, everybody, that's 99 years ago. This is gonna be a good class next year on the 100th anniversary. 99 years ago, the Menorah Wine Company was raided by a prohibition officer by the name of Izzy Einstein. That itself is an interesting question. Izzy Einstein was a nice Jewish man from the Lower East Side. He knew Yiddish and he understood the way the Jews worked. So the government hired him to infiltrate the Jewish wine company. And he found that the Menorah Wine Company was actually selling wine to customers without permits. You know, again, people came before Pesach, people were giving money to the Menorah Wine Company and they were distributing wine. And basically he closed down the Menorah Wine Company. The problem was that it seems to be that even after he discovered this problem, all the wine seemed to be miraculously returned to Menorah, and Menorah went ahead again and was distributing this wine, which basically means that the take was not only that Menorah was making money on this, but there actually were agents out there who were working for Menorah who were distributing wine and they were taking a cut in this and Menorah was taking a cut in this. And believe it or not, the rabbis were very much involved in this whole operation. And therefore, this became a huge deal. If you Google, you know that New York Times front pages, you can now find the articles. If you Google Menorah Wine Company 1921 New York Times, you will see that on the front page of the New York Times, they wrote up this whole issue, which actually is amazing. And it actually went back to a rabbi whose name is very familiar to a lot of us. That rabbi's name is Ramaz, Rabbi Moshe Zvulun Margolis, of course, after whom the Ramaz school is named. And the Ramaz was the leading rabbi in New York at the time. He was the rabbi of KJ. He was the Yiddish-speaking rabbi of KJ. He was the leading rabbi of New York. The Ramaz believed that only Orthodox rabbis should be allowed to give out these licenses for buying wine. He didn't think the conservative reform rabbi should have any say in this at all. Obviously, the conservative reform rabbis were hugely insulted by this, and it meant that the conservative reform Jews didn't have wine for Pesach. Now, at the beginning, Rabbi Margolis was able to control the monopoly. Seems Rabbi Margolis, of course, also was getting a cut in this whole business. At the beginning, Rabbi Margolis was able to control the monopoly. But after this whole fiasco in the Menorah Wine Company, they exposed Rabbi Margolis and the fact that he was trying to have him get a monopoly in this. And the conservative and the reform rabbis began to protest. They wanted a say in who would get wine. This went on for a little while. And concurrent with this, parallel to this, the conservative movement decided that maybe there was a better way to deal with this problem than to get permission to distribute wine. And therefore, on January 24th, 1922, there was a press conference at the Jewish Theological Seminary on 122nd Street and Broadway. At this press conference, Rabbi Louis Ginsburg, Rabbi Louis Ginsburg was the Talmud professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary. You know, in those days that the professors at JTS were Orthodox. Louis Ginsburg had been brought up in Kovna and studied in the yeshivas of Eastern Europe. He was very well versed in the Talmud, in the codes. He knew a lot. And he wrote, believe it or not, a 71-page tshuva, a 71-page responsum explaining that grape juice was not only permitted to say a borei piagofen upon and allowed for kiddush and allowed for the four cups of wine, but actually it was preferable. And he explained, based on the thing that I introduced earlier, that the Gemara knew already about something called yayin migito. Yayin migito means that that wine, grapes, before they go through the fermentation process, that they are already drinkable as wine, and you're allowed to make a borei pri hagafen on that wine. So that even though usually we don't drink wine that way, usually we don't drink wine pre-fermentation, but you can drink wine pre-fermentation. And therefore, of this 71 pages, and you can get these 71 pages on HebrewBooks.org. If you Google Louis Ginsburg, grape juice, you can get a copy of this. He basically spends 65 pages going through in the most complicated halachic detail why grape juice is allowed to make kiddush and to drink it the same. The last five pages, he gave away his real secret. In the last five pages, he said that the Orthodox had made a tremendous chilul Hashem, that the Orthodox had made a tremendous, tremendous desecration of God's name through the Menorah Wine Company, through the Ramaz, who was trying to control the licenses on the wine. He says, and basically, rather than fight the Orthodox, the best way to do it is to ignore the Orthodox. And let's just use grape juice instead of wine. So what do you think? What do you think the reaction was to Louis Ginsburg's tshuva. So for 5 years, we have no official Orthodox response. All we have is the memoirs of Louis Ginsburg's son, Eli Ginsburg. He writes that he received threatening letters. People threatened to harm him because of his father's tshuva, and that his mother didn't want him to go outside by himself. That's how bad the situation seemed to be. But then in 1926, finally, there was an answer that was written by a rabbi. And this also is an interesting story. The rabbi's name was Rabbi Isaac Simcha Horowitz. He was a rabbi in Hartford, Connecticut. A great Talmud Chacham, a great scholar. He wrote a book on the Sefer HaMitzvos called Yad HaLevi. And it's quoted in a whole bunch of different places. It's a very impressive book. Now, why is that interesting just for the historians of American Orthodoxy? This guy, you think today, you think about, you know, communities. If you're a great rabbi, a great scholar, you want to go to a community where there are a lot of people, where you can teach Torah, where you can be a big rabbi. Rabbi Isaac Simcha Horowitz was one of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim in America at the beginning of the 20th century. What is he doing in Hartford, Connecticut? I hope there's nobody here from Hartford, Connecticut, because what is he doing in Hartford, Connecticut? There was literally nobody in Hartford, Connecticut. The answer is, of course, something about the American Orthodox community. And that is, you came to the United States at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, people, most of these men didn't speak English. They couldn't get jobs. And, you know, these rabbis, you could get a job as a rabbi in New York. Everybody wanted to be a rabbi in New York. So these rabbis got jobs literally wherever they could get a job. This guy, Rabbi Horowitz, got a job in Hartford, Connecticut. I don't know his story, but he got a job in Hartford, Connecticut. The rabbi I spoke about last week when I talked about Coca-Cola, he got a job in Atlanta, Georgia, long before Atlanta, Georgia was a kind of a hotbed of Orthodoxy. So people got jobs wherever they could get jobs. Now, the good thing was that they got jobs. Their jobs were not very time consuming because there weren't very many people there. They were able to write books. And this Rabbi Horowitz writes books. And he writes a book. And in this book, he discusses Rabbi Louis Ginsburg's responsum about the use of grape juice for Kiddush. And I read you just a little piece in Hebrew, which I'll translate, just because the language is so sharp. You should just know something. Lithuanians, Bella, are very sharp, correct? Sometimes they tend to be very sharp, and that sharpness can sometimes be mean. Listen carefully. V'hinei lo avo bazel l'hagein al kvod Rabbeinu hamagen Avraham. I'm not going to defend the rabbis of old who were, you know, who thought you should use wine for Kiddush. I'm not going to defend them. Mehasagas hadardiki hazeh, from the opinion of this child. Asher kimidumeli, it appears to me, he says, she'ein lo moach bekad kado. It seems to me as if he has no brain in his head. That is the kind of way we talked when we were in third grade. We said, you have no brain in your head, in your skull, right? That's what he says about Louis Ginsburg. He says, Louis Ginsburg's 71-page tshuva, it's like he has no brain in his head. And he basically goes and he tries to argue that grape juice, not only is grape juice not preferable, but he thinks grape juice is like orange juice or apple juice. You wouldn't even make a Borei Pri HaGafen on grape juice. Now, of course, the disagreement between Rabbi Ginsburg and Rabbi Horowitz has very little to do with grape juice and has very little to do with prohibition. It had to do with tradition. Rabbi Horowitz said, my grandfather made Kiddush on wine, my father made Kiddush on wine, and I'm going to make Kiddush on wine. Rabbi Ginsburg, who was part of the Jewish Theological Seminary, didn't look at it that way. He said the times require us to make a certain kind of decision, meaning that prohibition and the Chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name that was being caused because of the kind of monopoly on wine, requires us to make a decision that we wouldn't usually make. So now the question is, who won? And you would think that Rabbi Horowitz should beat Rabbi Ginsburg. Rabbi Ginsburg is a conservative rabbi, or at least a rabbi in a conservative place. You would imagine that he would win over Rabbi Ginsburg. But it's not true. First of all, 1933, the 21st Amendment repeals prohibition. None of this is relevant anymore. We don't have much of a discussion of this until around the 1980s, in which time you have a rabbi from Brooklyn, Rabbi Menashe Klein, who writes a tshuva in which he says that grape juice is okay for Kiddush and grape juice is okay for the four cups of wine. Okay? He doesn't quote Rabbi Ginsburg. He would never quote a JTS tshuva. But he says that grape juice is okay. And those of us who grew up during this period remember that we did drink grape juice for Kiddush even during this period. I don't know exactly when grape juice was introduced. I don't know the history of Kedem grape juice. It's probably a good question. I don't know the history of Kedem grape juice. But definitely by the 1970s, people were using Kedem grape juice. The question is, okay, so you're allowed to use, so the first interesting piece of this story is that basically there was a disagreement between an Orthodox rabbi and a JTS rabbi whether you're allowed to make Kiddush on grape juice, which was caused by the prohibition. Ironically, grape juice won against the opinion of the Orthodox rabbi, and already by the 1960s and 70s, grape juice was being used by Kiddush. The question is, what about the four cups of wine at the Seder? Do the four cups of wine at the Seder have a different status? So the Gemara says as follows. You know, today the wine that we drink is a combination of five parts water, one part wine. It's mostly diluted wine. To drink wine is like to drink wine syrup. So the Gemara in Pesachim has a discussion. What happens if you drink wine syrup that was not diluted? And the Gemara says that if you drink wine syrup at the Seder that was not diluted, that the Gemara says, and I quote, "Yidei yayin yatsa, yidei cheirus lo yatsa." You fulfill the mitzvah borei pri hagafen, but there's a special mitzvah on Pesach. That's the mitzvah of cheirus. Cheirus means freedom, that you have to drink wine like free people. Free people do not drink wine syrup. Free people drink real wine. So therefore, to drink wine syrup, you would not fulfill the obligation of cheirus. Now, based on that, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes the following. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes that wine that is not intoxicated, like grape juice, is not preferable at the Seder. And he says that, and he compares wine that's not intoxicating grape juice to this wine that was not diluted. He says, just like wine that's not diluted is not the way of free people to drink, that's not the way you celebrate, so too drinking grape juice is not the way that you celebrate. And therefore, he says that it's preferable not to use grape juice at the Seder, and if you're able, you should drink wine rather than grape juice at the Seder. That was the opinion of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Who disagreed with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein? So the answer is Rabbi Soloveitchik. The Rambam in the Laws of the Seder says the following: Arba koso toelu tzarech limzo gotam, you have to dilute them. Kidei shetihye shtia areva. You should dilute the wine so that it'd be an enjoyable drink. Hakol lefi hayayin ulefi dat hashoteh. The measure The percentage by which you dilute the wine is dependent on the wine and is dependent on the drinker. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, to drink wine if you don't enjoy wine is against the Rambam, who says that the drinking of wine at the Seder should be areva, should be enjoyable. The most important thing is that the wine at the Seder should be enjoyable. And therefore, Rabbi Soloveitchik says that you do not need to apologize for drinking grape juice at the Seder. If you prefer grape juice at the Seder, so then you are absolutely allowed to drink grape juice and you do not have to apologize for drinking grape juice at the Seder. And the tradition, also interesting, you have a disagreement between Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, both of the last generation. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein died in 1986. Rabbi Soloveitchik died in 1993. So it's a last generation. So who's won? You know, you can sometimes, it's hard to ask that question in the moment. You can only ask that question over time. And the answer is, of course, that Rabbi Soloveitchik has won. And if you check all the Pesach books, every Pesach book will tell you that it is preferable to drink grape juice if that's what you prefer. Now, if you prefer wine, you don't have to drink grape juice. You can drink wine or you can drink grape juice. But they're equally good at the Seder. Each one fulfills the obligation of the four cups of wine at the Seder. So what do you have? So as we sit down for the Seder on Wednesday night, and some people will pour wine, and some people will pour grape juice, and some people will pour some kind of combination between wine and grape juice. It's amazing to think, number one, that grape juice as we know it was only invented in the 1880s by Dr. Welch. We'll always think of him every time you think of Welch's grape juice. That it was only invented in the 1880s. And that basically, the discussion about whether or not grape juice is accepted as a drink that you can use for Kiddush and you can use for the four cups of wine is something that only came to the fore during Prohibition in the early 1920s. And it came to the fore not because of some halakhic problem with wine, but because of a practical problem with wine. And actually, ironically, it wasn't a practical problem with wine that they couldn't get wine. They could get wine. The problem with wine was that they were misusing the ability to get wine. And because of that Chilul Hashem, Rabbi Louis Ginsberg introduced the fact that grape juice at least then was preferable to wine, and over time that grape juice became acceptable. If you would say to a Haredi today who sits down at his Seder that, you know, the reason that you're drinking grape juice at the Seder is because of a professor at JTS who 1921 came out against the Orthodox rabbinate and said you should drink grape juice instead of wine, the guy would tell you, like Rabbi Horowitz said to Rabbi Ginsberg, you have no brain in your head, right? He would tell you have no idea what you're talking about. But actually, that is the story. So as we sit down to drink our grape juice on Wednesday night, we can thank Rabbi Louis Ginsberg, and we can thank the story of American politics, prohibition in American politics, for giving us grape juice and allowing us to enjoy the Seder as we do. Thank you so much. Anybody who has any questions, Jay, if you want to unmute or they
can unmute
as you wish.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for the very interesting share, really very, very enjoyable. And I'm going to unmute everybody in a moment. Just to let you know, 2 o'clock this afternoon, we have a special share, Dr. Avram Steinberg, probably the world's greatest expert on medicine and halakha. We'll be talking about public policy and halakha and COVID-19. 8:30 this evening, Dr. Dan Reinhold, professor of philosophy at the Bernard Rebbe Graduate School. He's spoken the past couple weeks. Excellent. He'll be giving a talk on free will and Pesach and God's heart and heart, etc., from a philosophical perspective. I invite everybody. That's 8:30. And tomorrow morning, Ari Zivotofsky from Israel will be giving a share on the history of soft and hard matzah. So I invite everybody to that. And keep look at your emails. If you're not on our email list for follow-up, please God will, I guess. And anyway, we'll be continuing after Pesach. Maybe we'll have a shiur or two over on Chol HaMoed. And I'm going to unmute everybody. So if anybody has any questions, they can ask or put it in the chat box. Okay, thank you very much. And we hope to see you soon. And we wish everybody to be healthy and be well and an enjoyable Pesach under whatever circumstances. I was speaking to somebody earlier today who's going to be alone, an older woman, and she said she's kind of looking forward. She can sing all the songs she wants to sing she grew up with, because when she's with her family, they outvote her on the song. So she's going to sing the song she likes. Okay. All right.
Okay. Why was there no halachic discussion of grape juice between the 30s and Rabbi Klein's shuv in the 80s? Is it because people weren't drinking it or because it was so popular? That's a very good question. The answer is that traditions die hard. And if everybody is drinking wine, it takes at least a generation. Again, if you grew up and your father drank wine, the idea of drinking grape juice was something that took a long time. But that is a very interesting question. And I didn't do that sociology. You know, you need to speak to someone from the 50s and you need to ask them, was there grape juice on the table in the 50s? I can tell you that by the time I was, you know, Jay and I, we kind of grew up in the 60s, but we only remember the 70s. Right. Is that fair to say? So
that's
in the 70s, Jay, we had grape juice already at the table. But you and I are not responsible for the 50s and 60s.
I drink wine, by the way. Other people in family drink grape juice.
There you go. You're the Kelmans are traditional.
No, not the Kelmans. Me. Not the rest of the Kelmans.
Oh, okay. Very good. Okay. Any other questions? Good. So thank you very much. It's really nice to see you. A treat. And thank you, Rabbi Kelman. And Chag Kasher V'Sameach. Stay well, everybody. And Chag Sameach.
Thanks, Mac. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day. Bye-bye.